high again, 83. The numbers now, humidity 75%, 73 Kenosha, 72 Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We begin today's program by hearing more from Matthew Ferentz, who was my morning show guest yesterday, the author of an intriguing book called I Hate It Here, Please Vote for Me, Essays on Rural Political Decay. Ferentz is a creative writing professor at Allegheny College, and he ran for political office as a progressive Democrat in the decidedly conservative county of Crawford County, Pennsylvania, which roughly lies at the intersection between what we call the Rust Belt and Appalachia. Matthew Ferentz is originally from this part of Pennsylvania, so he knows this part of the country very, very well, and has given great thought to the way in which this part of the country, and in fact, much of rural America, is viewed, and the political consequences of some of those attitudes. Here is more from my conversation that we recorded about his book, again titled, I Hate It Here, Please Vote for Me, Essays on Rural Political Decay. Let's finish out by talking about a few, maybe more specifically, political matters that you bring up in your really interesting book. One of your core issues or concerns is, in a sense, the way in which a progressive candidate like you, in the heart of a place like Crawford County, are essentially left to your own devices. I mean, in a boat without a paddle or whatever metaphor, appeals to you. But you are given essentially little, if any, help because time and energy and resources end up getting diverted to greener pastures where there is at least the possibility of actual victory. One of the ways in which this became all too clear to you, and you already had some sense of this, was when a certain noteworthy Democrat visited town for a spring breakfast. And what he ended up saying and not saying during this visit proved to be acutely disappointing to you. Tell our listeners just a little bit about this really interesting moment during your campaign.
Yeah, so this was a very tall, Carhartt-wearing, then Lieutenant Governor of Pennsylvania, people put those pieces of the puzzle together. And he came to our county breakfast, and there were two candidates who were going to be on the ballot. It was actually before the primary, but we were both uncontested in the primary. One was running for the U.S. House of Representatives, and then I was running for the State House of Representatives. And his message to the gathering of the Democratic Party was that, you know, it's hard to be a Democrat in a rural place like this, and so your job is to go out and get more votes for Joe Biden. And he didn't reference my race or Christie's race. That was the person running for the U.S. House. And I was insulted, fair to say. Like, hey, man, this is supposed to be our home turf, and you're here to help get us all jazzed for this election. And then, as it so happened, we all rushed up the interstate to Erie for another rally later that afternoon. And since my district was also in Erie, I was there. And the message was completely different. It was about how Erie County is a bellwether county, and the fate of the nation runs through Erie, and we need to elect every candidate on the ballot. And so that meant that in the matter of a couple hours, I was told in my hometown, or where I live, that I don't matter on the ballot, and then up in Erie County was told that I matter on the ballot. And eventually I realized he was absolutely right from a political perspective, that statistically speaking, from an elections concept, you're going to get hammered in a place like Crawford County, where only about 35% of people are Democrats, and that's my vote share. That was my vote share in the election. But that also means the only places where they're investing money and time, and more importantly, effort to tell the story of what the party believes in, are places that are already going to vote for Democrats or places that are close and so are contested elections. That leaves a massive void of idea in large swaths of America where nobody's trying to change the thinking and to show there are different alternatives of thinking politically in places that are dominated by one party or the other. So since the party is built to win elections, that's what it is. And it is, that's actually a neutral statement to me. That is just what it is. It leaves that emptiness. And so we have cleaved so far into a binary of red versus blue, because that binary is very useful and efficient for campaigning. And so in a certain way, a party, Democratic Party, doesn't mind not paying attention to Crawford County because they don't have to waste resources there. And I think we could do better for everyone if we were actually investing in messaging all the time on what will help instead of what will win an election.
Right. It's intriguing to think about the fact that when you ran, the breakdown, was it 60-40 or 65-35? I can't remember.
65-35.
Okay. It's interesting when you think about 65-35 or maybe 60-40, which is often the way such elections play out. And we tend to call that, you know, a decisive, we might even call that a lopsided election. But 35-40% of the population, that's a lot of people. And one of the things that is one of your biggest concerns, and of course, we should say that, you know, much of what you're talking about, we could talk about in the exact reverse, that in some place where 35-40% of the population are more conservative, if their leadership is on the other side, it's also very often a case where then we see this sense of disenfranchisement. I think at one point you say, you know, these people who live in Crawford County, who voted for you, are in a sense politically invisible. And what they want for their community, for their own lives, essentially doesn't matter to anybody. And I'd never stopped to think about that and never stopped to think about what it would feel like to be part of that, in a sense, completely unrepresented political minority.
Yeah. So the House districts in Pennsylvania are each about 66,000 residents, and 12,000 people voted for me. And I think it was around 20,000 voted for the incumbent. So that's 12,000 people who affirmatively actually went to the polls and voted for me, and it didn't matter. And like you said, I mean, that's true in lots of different places. And, you know, right now, unfortunately, we're in a moment where there is such a divide between what happened to the Republican Party, which I would say has been overthrown, and there are a lot of Republicans who have seen their own party be taken away from them, even though it's called that. But back in a different day that we can imagine, there actually is a lot of value in a very Democratic district of listening to what a conservative constituent would say, so that we can have a spirited, good-natured, serious debate about how to approach problem solving. But when 12,000 people might as well, as far as my race went, not show up, that's a problem. It's easy to show up for a president when you're voting, and it matters. You know, those votes do matter. In Pennsylvania, it went for Joe Biden narrowly in 2020. And I actually did a little bit better than Joe Biden in Crawford County, which is interesting. But presidential politics don't have as much impact on your daily life as state-level politics. And so when you're disenfranchised in this way, when the polarization means it doesn't matter that you went to vote, then your daily experience is to be ignored and to not have what you care about valued. And so we see that in school boards with the banning of certain books that's happened around here as in other places. And that banning has everything to do with telling people in that school district that their lives are not valuable. And that's what I think we need to think about as voters and citizens, is that everybody is in this. Politics are something else, and we need to make sure all voices are being honored, unless they're wackadoodles. That's a different story.
Right.
But that there's a lot of really good people who are being ignored.
Speaking of that, even beyond the specific point we were just talking about, you at one point in your book say, consider the cliches of rural spaces. White, yeah. Straight, at least a little racist, undereducated, working class, Republican. But you go on in that same paragraph to actually describe the surprisingly, maybe even remarkably, diverse population of Crawford County. And I suspect Allegheny College is a major factor in that, but nonetheless, it just underscores the fact that even a lot of us who really try to be smart and thoughtful about these things do really tend to paint with a really broad brush. And that if there are enough 60-40 elections all across the country, it's very easy to forget about that other part of the equation, which, as you're saying, even in rural America, is more diverse than we might actually recognize.
Yeah. And in a place like this, there's no doubt the visibility of different kinds of diversity is going to be higher because of the presence of Allegheny College. But there's a lot of invisibility of those diversities in other communities because, you know, if you're growing up gay in a really conservative rural place, it's likely you're not going to have a critical mass of people that makes it safe for you to be known as gay, for example. And I'm thinking about, I'm going to mention Tractor Supply, TSC, the company that a couple of weeks ago, under pressure from the right wing, decided that it was going to pull back on its diversity efforts, its climate change efforts, and all these things that would be called, quote, woke politics. And that was a grave disappointment to me because in a not small way, a store like that, which is serving primarily rural areas, is recognizing that people exist in those rural spaces that shouldn't be made to feel exiled. And the pressure campaign reasserts the story that, for example, there are no gay people in rural America, or that being gay is not consistent with being a farmer. That's just not true. And that's, you know, going back to that void of idea, that's one of the things I worry about, is somebody who grows up in a place like this and has to hide who they are or has to leave because the only place they can be themselves is not the landscape that they love so much. For me, I can get away with being in a place like this because I'm not going to be under any threat walking down the street. But some people just couldn't. They couldn't stay. And I think that's a great tragedy.
Of course, so much of what this is about, as we've already been talking about, is careless generalizations, and sometimes made with, you know, really sort of clever wordplay. But that should not disguise the fact that some serious disrespecting is going on in both directions. At one point, you quote the famous political strategist James Carville as saying that Pennsylvania is Pittsburgh and Philadelphia with a lot of Alabama in between. And right. you go on to say his insult is a glaring example of the kind of condescension that drives so many Trump voters to gnash their teeth about liberal elites. What would be your advice, apart from the obvious, which is refrain from doing that? Refrain from those kind of insults, however clever they might sound.
Yeah, I mean, that's good advice right in it. But, you know, there's deeper advice is when an insult like that is formed, you know, that that line from Carville is kind of remarkable in that Alabama is really hit hard in that sentence. And Alabama is a complex, diverse state that, so he's right, actually, in a certain way, because Alabama is more complex. He didn't mean to be right. So we always have to, I think, when we've got a zinger, think about what is the story, the metaphor that's underneath the zinger. And that's why I say politics is such a narrative problem, and that being better readers in a literal way and a figurative way is a way to better politics, because we start reading through those layers of, okay, so why is Alabama the punchline of that statement? So not only is he insulting the non-urban parts of Pennsylvania, but he's using Alabama as part of that insult. And then you start being able to drill down through all of the different ways that we're just taking the easy pot shot and not thinking about the complex tapestry of life and the reality that things are always more complicated than they appear. Maybe more practical advice, or I don't know, I think that's fairly practical advice. Read a lot of books. That's part of it. But it's also to recognize that when you're listening to politicians and political pundits, they want to simplify it, and they don't want you to drive into that depth. And so you have to be careful to make sure that you're not being fed the story you think is already true, but you're really thinking about what's happening. Weirdly, I'm put in mind of things like QAnon now, in that I think part of how that became influential and big was because people do recognize that they're being sold false stories, and then new false stories, unfortunately, fill in that gap. Just to emphasize, QAnon is not cool. It's terrible and has had, I was just reading an article, an unknown negative consequence to the politics of America. But because everything is artifice, people have a desire to find the, quote, real story, and that can be co-opted by extremists as easily as it can be used as a tool to combat extremism.
Just a couple more quick questions, if you don't mind. Another bit Absolutely. Of advice that you give is is at that point in the book that I quoted earlier when you confess disappointment and annoyance with polite tactics in impolite arenas. One of your suggestions is that if and when one is engaging in what will most likely be an unsuccessful campaign effort, at least in terms of the election results, there's a need to make noise. And again, this is not limited, I should think, to one party or the other, or, you know, one side or the other, but that should be part of the point. Although, you know, sometimes we maybe talk about the noise of political campaigns in kind of a negative way, but I think you're kind of using that term in a different way, and in a way that ultimately could be and would be quite productive.
Yeah. So what I'm specifically thinking about there are in so many places where, say, it's hard to be a Democrat or hard to be a Republican, the candidate tries to moderate, using that political term, their message so that they become, like in the Democratic context, Republican-like. And they're going to lose anyway, is my point, is that if you're in a place where you're overwhelmingly disfavored in the election, trying to pretend that you're a moderate, it just means you're going to be defeated without getting any message apart. So in many ways, the non-competitive political landscape is the place where people can actually tell the truth and they can actually say what they believe, because you're not losing anything when, like in my case, you're saying, yeah, I believe in single-payer health care. I believe in public education. I believe in environmental protection. Three absolute loser policy planks in a hard right district, but also three political planks that matter to the daily life here. And so that's the opportunity I wish we would see happen in non-competitive places. That's the kind of noise we can make, or what John Lewis said, good trouble that can be made, is to stand up with very little consequence other than discomfort against the very narrow bands of what's palatable politically.
A last question. You say that one of the harder truths of your candidacy was that you should have lost. That,
yeah.
I think you're saying, and it's kind of poetic justice that you did lose. And you go on to explain that, you know, that you were running not to represent your region, but to transform it. And I think you're touching on something which is such an intriguing conundrum for a whole lot of people. And again, I think this is true on both sides of the aisle in terms of seeing much that needs to be changed and yet struggling to know just kind of how to go about doing that, and without it crossing a certain line where it becomes, where concern becomes a sort of disdain. Tell us more about what I'm sure are some of your most conflicted feelings about the way you undertook this campaign, and maybe some of those attitudes of yours that were at the heart of it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the most conflicted part is that it's hard and it remains difficult to live in a place where, you know, if you just grabbed a person on the street and had a discussion about what you believed in politically, they probably wouldn't agree with you. Or another example was a conversation I was having with two, like, verifiably really good people who I like. I don't know them well, but I like them and I can tell they're good people. And it was at one of my kids' events. And they were suddenly talking about the most extreme right-wing stuff that is abhorrent to me. And it was a very paralyzing moment, because it wasn't a situation where I wanted to get in an argument, because, you know, it's my kid's thing. But those are the difficult moments that make it hard to continue living in a place where you're surrounded by so much that you deeply object to. But at the same time, I've lived in a lot of places, and there is no part of America that is more me than Western Pennsylvania. It's the landscape, it's the accent of people on the street, it's just the way things are doing. This is my home, it's where I'm from. And so that's the conflict that is so hard to reconcile. If there's one thing I wish I had made even more clear in the campaign, it would be that, and I think I tried, but it's hard to really get at that, you know, you can love this place and be something that the place is ready to discard at all times. And then I wish I had been even more forceful in taking my own advice to push issues and not try to be, I wasn't moderate, but in certain ways, I think I could have been even more aggressive in making a claim for this place as mine also? It's a hard question, actually, in some ways, to sort out. I guess I should write a book about it. Oh, I guess I did.
I think you did, and a good book about it, as a matter of fact. And by the way, I should tell our listeners, we've really just scratched the surface there. I mean, all that we've talked about, you can explore in greater detail by actually reading the book, and there are interesting matters that we did not even touch on, like the time you spent in Paris, France, which really helped you understand the plight of the immigrant and what bureaucracy is all about. You tell us about your parents' farm and how it has been transformed in part by not being productive in the classic sense of the word, but it has gone on to be something else and, in a sense, something even more beautiful. And, of course, you talk at even greater length about the place of poetry and literature and story in all of our lives. And at one point you write, "I want to live in a place I love. I want to live in a place that loves me too." That and so much more is in this wonderful book called I Hate It Here, Please Vote for Me, Essays on Rural Political Decay, published by West Virginia University Press, and the author, Matthew Ferrance. Matthew Ferrance, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. It was terrific to talk with you about your wonderful book. Thank you and best wishes.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, we're going into the Morning Show archives for an interview that was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2018. We're spending the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show with Dr. Benjamin Carter Hett, someone who is professor of history at Hunter College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He is someone who has studied 20th century history extensively and thoroughly and is responsible for a brand new book called The Death of Democracy, Hitler's Rise to Power and the Downfall of the Weimar Republic. This is a story that has not been very often or very thoroughly told. And it is also a story around which a lot of difference of opinion has swirled when it has been discussed. Namely, how did Adolf Hitler rise to power? And how did he rise to power so swiftly and so emphatically? And what was it that was at the heart of the downfall of the Weimar Republic? Was it doomed from the start? Or were there specific elements in this particular story and in particular certain key figures who were essential to the Republic falling and the Nazis rising in prominence? This thoroughly researched book offers some fascinating insights into that. And, of course, it also prompts some intriguing thoughts about current political controversies raging in the world today. And are there any lessons that can be learned from what occurred in Germany in the 1920s and early 30s? The book is published by Henry Holt and Company. Professor Benjamin Carter Hett, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
I'm glad we can have this conversation about this really important topic. One of the things that I said in the introduction that I wish you would talk about is sort of the confusion and or difference of opinion that has emerged over this. You call it one time the contradictory narratives offered by historians on the fall of the Weimar Republic. Can you just briefly sketch for us the nature of those disagreements about this important matter?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that what happened in Germany in that time, I think it's almost like a Rorschach test, in that a lot of what you see in there depends a lot on who you are and what you bring to it. And over time, you're absolutely right. There has been a lot of disagreement as to how this could happen, how you could get such a barbaric regime growing out of a very enlightened and progressive modern democracy. And there are a lot of, to mix the metaphor, there are a lot of what I would call sort of the usual suspects. So you'll often read, for instance, that the peace treaty that concluded the First World War with Germany, the Treaty of Versailles, was very harsh, and that fueled anger in Germany, which lifted Hitler to power. Or you will read, for instance, that the Constitution had fatal defects that allowed Hitler to come to power. Or you will sometimes read, especially in older books, that the Germans just are like that, and they're sort of an authoritarian-inclined people, and therefore they didn't really know what to do with democracy when they got it. In my view, those sort of, in a way, old classic explanations are all nonsense. The peace treaty didn't do much for Hitler, if only insofar as every German pretty much could agree that they didn't like it, and so it conferred no particular advantage on Hitler and his party. Everybody wanted to overturn the peace element somehow or work around it. The idea that Germans are just like that, I think, is a prejudice you tend to find among people who lived through the Second World War. But it's not a very serious, you know, scientific kind of hypothesis. And as for the Constitution, well, it had elements in it that I talk about in the book that did enable a dictatorship to evolve. But really, so does any legal system. You know, legal experts, and I once in my wild youth was a lawyer for a while, not that I'm a legal expert, but legal experts will often tell you that a legal text like a constitution actually can do relatively little to create a reality. Usually the reality of a society sort of, you know, fills in the constitution itself or the law itself, and a society shapes a law in its own images. So the constitution is not a very satisfactory explanation. So what I'm trying to do in the book is try to wrestle with this mystery and say, well, what do I think did happen? And that's really what I'm trying to do with the book.
Right. And to sort of cut to the chase, in a sense, I think part of what you're saying is that it was a matter, at least to some extent, of particular people being in particular positions that sort of led to a maybe special sort of chemistry, a chemical reaction of a political nature that set these events ultimately in motion.
Sorry, go ahead.
Could we for a moment have you probe a little deeper into something that you mentioned about the Weimar Republic, which at one point in the introduction to the book you call a state-of-the-art modern democracy. I was really floored as I read your description of all of the ways in which this Weimar Republic was extraordinarily progressive and impressive in a lot of different ways. Summarize for our listeners at least some of the most important ways in which this this new republic, this new democracy, was really quite impressive. And then give us some sense of how such an impressive democracy could maybe not be as strong and self-sustaining as it might appear.
Sure. Well, first, just to take the political level, the Constitution itself was something that I think you could call state-of-the-art and progressive for when it was drafted in 1919. There are a couple important elements of that. One is it had a Bill of Rights in it that went farther in some ways than what we have here in the United States. Notably, for instance, it expressly gave equal rights to men and women, which we still haven't managed to get to in our Constitution. And then there was the voting system, which is what you call a proportional system, which is still common in Europe today. Germany still has it. And how that works is, instead of voting in an election like we do for congressional elections, where you vote for a representative in your particular district, the way elections worked in the Weimar Republic is that you would vote simply for a party. And there were a great number of parties. There were about six that really mattered, but there were a lot more than that, some splinter parties. And then there's a perfect flow through of popular vote. So basically, whatever share of popular vote a party gets, that's the share of seats it gets in the national parliament, the Reichstag. So the parliament exactly reflects, you know, what the people as a whole wanted. Which a system like ours doesn't, or in some ways even less so in a place like Great Britain, where you can get minorities electing an administration quite commonly, I mean, a minority of voters. So in those respects, it really was quite state-of-the-art. And then in the sort of broader culture, which I think you were alluding to as well, it was an incredible time of creativity. It's one of those moments in human history where there just seems to be a lot of genius around in the arts, in science. You know, Albert Einstein was there. In music, in architecture and design, we still, you know, fill our houses with stuff that comes basically from the Bauhaus Design School and so on and so on and so on. So it was an incredible time. Now, you asked, how do you get from there to what happens after Hitler comes to power? And then a good part of it goes back to something else you alluded to, which is there were some people at the top in powerful positions who did not like the way the democracy was shaping, basically because it did not suit their interests. The most important were leaders of big business, and even more so perhaps leaders of the army. And they, around the late 1920s, around 1928 or so, they start working quite actively to see how they could subvert the democracy so that, you know, for instance, employers could weaken the power of unions and weaken the regulation of business, which they felt was cutting into their profit margins. And so the military people could find a way to build up the strength of Germany's armed forces again, which the democratic parliament refused to pay a lot of money for. They kept turning down defense appropriations, and the military commanders were driven crazy by that. So both of these groups wanted to find a way to basically push the parliament out of the picture and subvert the democracy and create a more authoritarian state that would do better for their interests. Hmm.
As you help piece together, in a sense, this mystery of the rise of something as horrific as Nazism out of this very impressive Weimar Republic, one of the things to which you point is the way in which the German people as a whole felt about the First World War. And I think one of the most intriguing points you raise is that it was not just the way they looked back at how the war ended, with, of course, a stinging defeat of the Germans and their allies, but also the way they looked back at the way the First World War had begun. And yep. That something about the contrast between those two moments in their recent history had a lot to do with sort of the tangle of intense emotions and resentments that were sort of at the heart of the German people as a whole at this point in time. What were you getting at there?
That's exactly right. When the First World War began, Germans, like people in every country really when the First World War began, felt that their country was being attacked. You know, young men rushed to the colors to defend it. And there was a great patriotic upsurge. There was in most countries in 1914 when the war began. And the war began in August in beautiful weather, bright sunshine, and that became sort of a part of the symbolism. And then the war ends, for Germany at least, in November with defeat and with a revolution that leads to a regime change, which is not popular with large numbers of the population. And the fact that this happens in November, in, you know, the cold, gray rain of sort of early winter, and that's associated with defeat, that actually became part of the symbolism in an odd way that the new democracy had to bear, that it's born out of defeat, and it's born out of, you know, simply kind of grim November. And grim November becomes, in a way, probably somewhat subconsciously, the way people think about the new system, whereas the war began in the glorious sunshine when Germans all felt they were unified, and with the defeat and the revolution, they feel they've become divided. And that tension then drove a lot of the politics of the 20s and early 30s. Hmm.
One of the interesting decisions that was made by the administrators at the top of the Weimar Republic as this man named Adolf Hitler began to slowly rise in popularity and significance, obviously speaking a word that spoke potently to many Germans, was their decision to, in a sense, bring him aboard rather than to keep him at arm's length to subjugate his influence, but rather to treat him as an ally that I think you tell us they assumed they could control. Tell us more about this alliance, which at least at one point in your book you call a very uneasy or awkward one. And and why they would enter into that, what was at the heart of their motivation to do so, and in what way did it go very wrong?
Yeah, so what starts happening in the later 1920s is that Hitler and his party, which hadn't gotten anywhere for almost 10 years in terms of success in elections, they suddenly start doing very well, first in state elections, and then from 1930 on in national elections. They start getting really rapidly a surge of votes. Pretty much literally overnight, Hitler becomes one of the most important politicians in the Republic. And this is being driven largely, if you look at, you know, where people first voted for Hitler and who supported him within the society, it's a basically rural protest vote being driven by the really hard conditions economically that Germany's, particularly its rural regions, were suffering in the later 1920s. The way I put it in the book is, Hitler's really leading something that's a protest movement against what economic globalization is doing to Germans at that time. And then, so some of the elite insiders, the advisors to the president, Paul von Hindenburg, they look at Hitler and they look at this movement. They look at Hitler and they see a guy who does not fit the image of senior politicians and statesmen of that time. He doesn't come from a prominent family. He comes from a very humble background. He doesn't even speak German correctly grammatically, which is hard to do, by the way, but if you're a native speaker, you should probably do it. He has little formal education. In the First World War, in 4 years of service, he never rose above the rank of the equivalent of private first class, which was virtually unheard of in the war. You'd usually get promoted up to the officer ranks if you served that long. And so they look at him and they say, this guy's basically a joke. He's a clown. But somehow he can get the people riled up in a way that we can't. And this comes back to the point about some of the elite military men and industrialists are trying to find a way to sort of undo the democracy and make things work better for them. And they start to conclude, this Hitler guy is kind of crude and rough and maybe a little alarming, but his followers are nationalist and they're angry, and they would certainly back a military buildup. And so maybe we can harness that. We can use him, we can control him, and we can take advantage of his support, and that will float our agenda. And Hitler will be too dumb to know what's going on. So this is basically the thinking that they have.
Your book, of course, explores all of these events in really amazing detail. One of the things you say is that in describing the work of historians, that our assemblage of our kind of collective knowledge of history is like a slow accretion of sediment. There is always a new layer being added. Can you say something about the way in which the study of this period is very much an ongoing process, and the fact that much of what has been written, and particularly much of what was written closer to this time, needs to be, well, if not outright discarded, at least needs to be used very cautiously because of the reasons that much of that early writing was created in the first place. I mean,
that's a great question. And it's something that I think maybe a lot of people, it would seem surprising to them, and yet it is true. History really is always a work in progress. And particularly for Germany in the 20th century, there are a couple of particularly powerful reasons for that. One has to do with source material. For a long time, you know, during the Cold War, there was a lot of important primary source material, government records and so on, that were held behind the Iron Curtain, whether it be in the government of East Germany or in some cases in the Soviet Union. They had scooped up a lot of German documents at the end of the war. And that material did not become freely accessible to scholars until, you know, roughly about the earlier mid-1990s. And some of it has really changed our picture of what happened back in the 20s, 30s, 40s. Another reason you alluded to is what I think is a fascinating, although slightly insidious, process. You have to remember that a lot of people who played important roles in this story, if they're still alive in 1945 at the end of the Second World War, suddenly they are faced with big problems. You know, if you were at all involved in politics and government, you are going to be facing what was called the denazification process run or overseen at least by the Allies. You might face war crimes trials. At the very least, you're probably going to feel a little bad about what happened. And so people really try to spin the past. They try to tell stories. about what happened in ways that sort of let them off the hook and thereby distort the reality. And a lot of historians, especially early on in the 50s and 60s, tended to swallow some of these stories quite whole. And so a lot of the research, if you go back a few decades, a lot of the research on this stuff really bears the marks of these stories that people told to get themselves off the hook, which we're now starting to see through a little bit. And then finally, there's what's going on in the world. I think if you are, you know, attentive to what's happening in the world in 2018, if you look around, I mean, just today we're hearing about the election in Hungary where the authoritarian Orbán has won a stunning victory, kind of inflated from his share of the popular vote. That's just one example among many of countries that became democracies, Hungary at the end of the Cold War, but now are sliding back into a kind of nastier authoritarianism. You know, the world we live in now, I think, does look disturbingly like the world of the 1930s. And I think with that perspective, too, we gain a little something if we think about what was happening in Germany in the 20s and 30s, bearing in mind some of what we are living through right now.
A quick word about that. Some people look at these events and draw very close parallels to, for instance, what is occurring right now in the United States and the rise to prominence and recent election of our current president, for instance. What is your word to people who would draw these parallels? Because I think no matter where somebody falls on the political spectrum, I think we all have to agree that it is sometimes tempting to draw parallels that in fact are not there, or to draw them more vividly or specifically than in fact historical events warrant. How would you have, for instance, current Americans treat the information that you share in this book? I mean, and what would you have us do in terms of drawing parallels between those events and the events we are living through right now?
Well, you're right. You're absolutely right that you don't want to kind of hysterically overdraw the parallels. But having said that, I would also say there is a quality of warning in what happened in Germany in the 20s and 30s. And I do think, and part of why I wanted to write this book, is that I do think in some sort of deep and structural ways, there are things in our politics now which do look a little bit like things that happened in Germany then, and which, whatever might happen, they cannot lead in a good direction. So, for instance, the bitter partisan divisions and the unwillingness to work with other parties and reach across the aisle, that was a feature of Weimar German politics, or the rage and anger that was directed at vulnerable refugees and immigrants in the Weimar Republic, or the ways in which powerful elites were really trying very hard to serve their own interests at the expense of the common good, and therefore were willing to make bad bargains, in a sense, to bring that about. I mean, all of these are not totally out of place in our politics today, and I think that's troubling. And I think Americans have a kind of innocence about things. We think we're good, our values are good, we're fine, nothing bad can happen. And I think we need to be aware of some of the nasty possibilities that might lurk behind certain political choices.
The book, again, is titled The Death of Democracy, Hitler's Rise to Power and the Downfall of the Weimar Republic, published by Henry Holt and Company, and the author, Benjamin Carter Hett. The book includes a very interesting list of cast of characters, as it were, and also an interesting list of the important political parties within the Weimar Republic, including, of course, the National Socialist German Workers' Party, which ultimately was the party of Hitler and the party of the Nazis. And there are photographs in the book as well, and the book is notated quite thoroughly as well. A valuable book in many, many respects. Professor Benjamin Carter Hett, I thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show, and very best wishes to you.
Thank you very much. It was a great pleasure talking to you.
The preceding Morning Show interview was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2018. Tomorrow and Thursday on The Morning Show, interviews surrounding the upcoming Harbor Park Jazz Rhythm and Blues Festival this Saturday. Tomorrow, the headliner among the musicians, South African jazz musician Jonathan Butler. On Thursday, two great chefs from Bartolotta restaurants in in Milwaukee, who will be participating in the festival's cooking studio. So that's over the next 2 days here on WGTD. Today, sunny skies and a high of 83 degrees. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.